Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It's Wednesday, February 8th, 2017. We have several interesting bills that we are going to have public hearings on. But before we do that, first of all, let me say two things, colleagues. First of all, if anyone was here for the trapping bill, Senate Bill 6, that meeting has been postponed. So I just want to announce that. Second, tomorrow is our first Thursday hearing. So just to remind you all that we
are. It could have been Friday afternoon.
We're not doing Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I think this space is available Friday afternoon from 3 to 5. So
if anyone wants to come.
We are ringing it out.
Yeah. I actually think Ways and Means is doing that to me. So we do have a Friday afternoon meeting here.
Perfect.
So it was nice not to have a conflict.
Right. So before we get into our public hearings, I'm going to open a work session for introduction of committee measures. Senator Olson.
Chair Dembrough, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1588 dated 12-1-16, LC 3058 dated 1-5-17.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved that LC 1588 dated 12-1-16 and LC 3058 dated 1-5-17 be introduced as committee bills. Colleagues, before we get into if there are any questions, let me just remind everyone that introduction of committee bills just gets these bills into the system. They do not indicate any support or opposition to these bills or that these bills will even be referred to this committee. But they will enter the process as a result of our action today. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none. Any opposition to the introduction of these measures? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, I'm going to close this work session on introduction of committee measures and open a public hearing on our first bill, and that is Senate Bill 326. And while Senator Olson and Senator Courtney want to come up to testify, Beth, would you tell us, please, what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 326 would create an income tax credit for adopting a cat or dog from an animal rescue entity. The credit allowed would be the lesser of $100 in the amount of qualified animal adoption expenses paid by the taxpayer.
Okay, thank you. All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Alan Olson. I am a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I am here in support of Senate Bill 326. The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated. A quote from Gandhi. Animals of all shapes and sizes end up in shelters. There are simply not enough good homes or even cages for them all. Please look at these faces of pets seeking a new life. How could you deny them a chance? If we don't give them their chance, this could be their fate. We only ask for a small amount of resources, a tax credit of up to $100 to offset the cost of adoption. If you're married, your spouse will also be allowed to file and to get an additional credit. I ask for your support. These animals ask for your support. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions.
Okay, before we do that, Senator Courtney, let's hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, who is joining with me on this bill, members of the Environment and Natural Resource Committee. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm State Senator, District 11, which is I reside here in Salem. And I'm here to support the bill that the good senator asked me to help him with, Senate Bill 326. Pet adoption today looks a lot different than it did when I was a kid. in Salem area, adopting a dog from the Willamette Humane Society starts at $100 and can go up to $350. Kittens, which used to be given away in front of grocery stores, are now available for adoption for $100. At the Marion County Animal Shelter, dog adoption costs around $175. The Portland Humane Society dog adoption fee is $250. At almost all shelters, you will also have to fill out an application about your family, the type of pet you're looking for, the resources and effort you are willing to put into a potential pet. I am not here to complain about the adoption process, I emphasize. There are good reasons for these costs. Our local shelters and humane societies are doing outstanding work. They find loving and safe homes for animals. Adoption costs have gone up because they include basic health services, vaccines and deworming, microchipping, spraying or neutering, which of course helps prevent future animal shelters. In addition to the minimum of $100 for adoption, cost of food, new toys, a bed, kennel, a leash, brush, litter box, obedience classes, pet registration, etc., add up. These things could easily add up to $500 or more. By adopting from a shelter or rescue group, an animal's life is being saved, a human's life is being made richer. I support this bill wholeheartedly. I think providing a tax return of up to $100 is the least we can do to reward someone for adopting a shelter pet. And just as a bit of a plug and a promotion, the Willamette Humane Society here in Salem, Oregon, is having a free adoption event this weekend. So if you can't wait for a tax credit, I encourage you to come down this weekend or stay here this weekend and help us end petlessness. Thank you, Your Honor, for allowing me to come here today and testify yet again in front of this august group of state senators.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for bringing the bill. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Senator Bertrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great bill. Wish I could say that on every bill in the building, but this is a great bill. As a person that sits on the Revenue Committee, we'll look at it again, and I'm just going to throw this out as a suggestion that maybe we should look at making it a deduction instead of a tax credit, since tax credits are seemingly to be unpopular in the Revenue Committee anymore. It might just be something. In other words, they could write off the entire adoption. So if it was $300 to adopt a pet, they could write that off their taxes. That's the difference between a tax credit and a deduction. It's just throwing it out there because it's got to go through revenue too.
Well, Chair Dembrough, Senator Bertrager, first of all, this is a great moment because I don't think I've ever referred to any bill as a great bill, so I'm pleased to hear that. My officer, I'm a private in this army, is Officer Olson, so I'll follow his lead. I just want the bill. And if that means I get the bill by making an deduction, it's this committee, first of all, we have to deal with. This committee has to decide individually and collectively they want this bill, or we're not even talking revenue. So I don't want to take you for granted. I don't know where Senator Brzezinski is on this. I don't know where Senator Dembrough is on it. I don't know where Senator Dembrough is on it. Excuse me, Roblin's on it. And I don't know where Beth Pacino, the analyst, is on it. So the fact of the matter is, I'm just asking this committee to move it to revenue with a due pass recommendation. And if you choose to do that, then, Senator Olson, you told me to respond. I'll go with that if that's the only way I can get the bill passed. But I'm speaking for Peter, and I don't want to bushwhack. That's a term I use in West By God, Virginia. I don't want to bushwhack my officer in charge. So that's the best I can do with that.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is an exceptional idea, and we will take a look at it because we've already heard slight problems with tax credits. I would like to say that as a new senator in 2011, the good president asked me to get on a bill for veterans and Veterans Day, and I got on it, and we got it passed, and I think this could be payback, but I thank him wholeheartedly for his support of this bill, because I think it's good for Oregon, and I think it really helps the pets, because they make your life so much better if you have one, and if you don't, you should. They can get you over the hard times, and they can really make your great times even better. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Yes, Senator Roble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for Senator Olson. Is this connected in any way with the bill over in the House to make the state dog, the shelter dog?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roble, no, it's not.
Okay.
I didn't even know that bill was in there, but I did know that we had the border collie also. So.
It's a competition.
Yeah.
Senator Brzozinski.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I see that this actually is for tax credit year starting 2017. So all of us who've been doing rescue recovery animals, we can't go back and get these tax credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzozinski, I would suggest that if you tried that, you would have another senator that's the head of revenue that would be most vociferous as to a no.
So on a more serious note, is there a limit as to how many tax credits or an individual could get in 1 year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzozinski, yes, there is. We included that because we didn't want it, it wouldn't hurt my feelings to have a person go out and adopt 5 or 10 dogs, but they say for each, I'm sorry, on the bill, first page, line 18, for each tax year for which a credit is claimed under the section, the taxpayer shall maintain records, and they're allowed to adopt one qualified adoption per year, and if they have a spouse, they can also get the same tax credit in the year. So you could, if, with your married, you can get two.
Okay, just curious. Thank you.
And just to clarify, Senators, that the bill defines qualified adoption expenses, and it lists them out, and it doesn't include the dog bed and dog food or any of that. It's the legitimate expenses related to the adoption.
Gotcha. Right? Mr. Chair, you're absolutely correct. We didn't, the good senator, the good president talked about the beds and toys and et cetera, et cetera. And that could get extremely costly, that the taxpayers or we, the state, would have to pick up the cost for toys. So we want to make certain that it dealt with the actual receiving of the dog with the shots and the requirements, the tags, and rabies shots and all that stuff, so that would be covered, but not the accoutrements that a dog or a cat would like to have.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a number of people who've signed up to speak to this. So if you would come up first panel, Amy Sachs, Ron Murray, and Elizabeth Young, please. And you can go in whatever order you want to go.
Senator Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Amy Sachs, and I'm here on behalf of Humane Oregon. We are a nonprofit board founded in 2014, advocating for animals in our legal process here in Oregon. So I am also the executive director and also the founder of the Pixie Project. We're an animal rescue and shelter. We provide personalized adoption services. Excuse me. We run a low-cost veterinary clinic for veterans, seniors, and those on government assistance of some form in order to help them get the care they need and keep their pet. From a strictly financial standpoint, I think we have addressed the wonderful things that an animal can bring into your life and the benefits of bringing a shelter animal in. We also spend $10 million a year in Multnomah County alone on animal control. Less animals in the shelter, shorter duration of time, less money. So if we can encourage and put adoption in forefront of people's minds, more people will adopt. If we can incentivize that, we will have less animals in our shelters and be able to dedicate those resources elsewhere.
Great, thank you.
My name is Elizabeth Young.
You can just pull that. Thanks.
I'm secretary on the board of directors for Oregon Friends of Shelter Animals. We take in animals that would be euthanized at other shelters. So every animal that we take in would not exist if it weren't for us. And there are other organizations that do the same. I think one of the great benefits of this bill would be not only giving incentive to people to adopt a pet, but possibly a second. And often I see how beneficial it is for a pet to have a companion pet. And something like this could really make that more possible and more realistic to somebody who might have a little bit of financial concern. And I think this would be a very wonderful thing for many shelters.
Great. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Ron?
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Ron Murray. Some of you may have remembered me from many years past. I was the lobbyist for the plumbers, and I retired, and I recommend that to all of you. But I'm here representing Oregon Dog Pack. We are the first companion animal political action committee in the state of Oregon, and I'm here to ask your support for Senate Bill 326. And the first thing I want to do is I want to address the elephant in the room, and I am a taxpayer. I'm on a fixed income, and who's going to pay for this? So I'm going to throw out some numbers. I live in Multnomah County in Portland, and please don't hold that against me. But with that, for every animal that crosses the threshold of Multnomah County Animal Services, it costs the taxpayer $1,600. Easy math, $11 million a year budget, 6,000 dogs and cats. That's a lot of money. There's a local organization of shelters in the Multnomah County area, and at a national conference, they said Multnomah County is the best-funded public shelter in the United States. With that, if we can have fewer animals that go to the shelter, if we can get them out of the door shelter, out of the shelter quicker, the cost for these shelter animals is going to decline. Obviously, the goal of all of us is to have no-kill shelters, and that doesn't mean the animals aren't euthanized. It simply means that all savable animals are euthanized. On the other side, I'm still paying for these animals because, like most of the animal lovers in this room, we donate thousands of dollars a year to all of the 501c3s, whether they're statewide or they're local. That's where we choose to put our money. So we are already putting our money forward to save these animals. I think Senate Bill 326 is just a very small step, and we're going to get the money back on the other end by lower costs at the public shelters. So if I can answer any questions, I would like to do so. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Well, Ron, since you offered to answer any question, and you represent the dog pack, so what do you think? Border collie or shelter dog?
Shelter dog.
Good answer.
And if I could tell you why, when my wife and I, when we were quite young and we just got married, we had to have a dog. So we bought a purebred English Springer Spaniel. And if you could have harvested the energy of all the English Springer Spaniels in Oregon, the energy crunch would be over. And now we pretty much go with the old ones. And the shelter dogs, they're great. They love you. Some of them have had a pretty rough road to hoe. We have now I'm dragging this out, but you asked. We have a dog that came from Arkansas. We just adopted 2 weeks ago a dog that was going to be put to sleep because their owner was going to pass away. The family didn't want it. So the first stop is the dog ophthalmologist. So there is no such thing as a free dog, and that should be on the top of any animal bill. Shelter dog.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
When we had the Hurricane Katrina, didn't Oregon accept several of the lost animals that
and
were there?
And OFASA took in a number from the Louisiana flood, and we were the only shelter that would accept animals that had slight medical conditions, ones that would require more effort on our part, more financial input on our part. But we were able to take those animals, get them healthy, and get them homes.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, all three of you. Okay, I'm going to call up Gail Murray, Marcia Kelly, and Scott Beckstead, please. Gail, you don't need to come up?
No.
Okay, that's fine. Great. Okay, then Marcia, why don't you go ahead, please? Welcome.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, and I'm the advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Just out of happenstance, I'm wearing cat earrings because I have a little black cat. I'm wearing a turtleneck that has little cats on it. It was a Christmas present from a friend. We have two shelter cats in our home that we adopted. But I'm opposed to a tax credit for adopting pets. In just a little bit of time, looking at Portland, Salem, Eugene, Bend, and Medford, I came up with 24,220 animals adopted last year. That's not the whole state. Couldn't find information on Pendleton. The cost of adoption is not so onerous that people cannot afford it. Part of the pet problem is failing to neuter or spay animals and feral animals. As a happenstance, the director of the Willamette Humane Society spoke at my Kiwanis group yesterday, and they're very proud of their feral cat neutering program. They clip the ears so people know that the feral cat has been neutered. They get complete treatment while they're neutering, worming, and et cetera. And the feral cats don't necessarily return because they clip the ear off so that people who are out trying to help feral cats know that they've already been neutered. It's been very successful, and they have a high adoption rate. They work with other shelters in the area for problem pets and exchange. I'm here to say that a lot of the societies are 501c3s, so the donations to them are already tax deductible. They have fundraisers. They have thrift stores. I buy things at both the Salem Friends of Felines and the Willamette Valley Humane Society thrift store in Salem. In Salem, they get dogs flown in from, get this, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Antonio, Oklahoma, and Maui for adoption, because people have been successful in sort of the neutering program. There are licensing fees that help support the county or the city's public shelters. And in Salem, the Humane Society works with a public shelter to take in dogs. We are facing a $1.8 billion potential shortfall in the co-chair's budget. And at my figures, just looking at a few of the adoptions last year, that would be $2.5 million that would not be available to fund programs that the state needs to fund. I love my kitties. I hope they talk to me after I come home. But I don't think a $200 tax credit would have made a difference to my spouse. And I don't think it would make a difference to very many people. I think one of the other issues that we should probably address when we're talking about pets are the rules and regulations that disallow people to have pets in their living accommodations. I'm happy to answer what questions I can. I don't know how much it costs to license a pet in every jurisdiction, but it looks like Multnomah County licenses cats.
Thank you very much, Marcia. Scott?
Thank you, Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Beckstead. I'm the Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. The HSUS is an advocacy organization. We do not operate brick-and-mortar animal shelters like the Oregon Humane Society or the Humane Society of Central Oregon, but we take a very active interest in promoting responsible pet adoptions, and we have very good relationships with the animal shelters and the humane societies throughout Oregon. We put on what's called the Animal Care Expo, which is a national, actually an international convention every year that trains shelter professionals on how to do their jobs better. And we have a close relationship with the National Ad Council, with whom we've run millions of dollars worth of ads promoting pet adoption. So it's hard for me to see a downside to Senate Bill 326. It seems to me that this is a bill that is encouraging people to adopt animals. And while there may be a revenue side to this bill, it seems to me that ultimately this is going to save the taxpayers money, because it's going to mean fewer animals being paid for or being cared for at taxpayer expense. So we support Senate Bill 326, and we hope you'll support it too. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Scott. Colleagues, questions for Marcia or Scott? Senator Bretschiger.
Marcia, you heard me talk about tax credits. What's your feeling on moving it from a tax credit to a tax deduction?
It's probably about the same thing. I believe that through private donations, responsible pet ownership, responsible spay and neuter programs, we're getting a handle on it. And I think that if you go to the humane societies and find out the instances of euthanasia because they have no place to put a pet are decreasing greatly. Now, they do euthanasia. They do it at the request in Salem, at the request of a pet owner for a low-cost euthanasia or a low-cost cremation of a pet as part of their services, because they understand that sometimes that does have to happen. But I think that if you look at some of the figures from the Humane Societies, you will find that we are getting a handle on it through other ways. I'd be happier to see something that was doing grants for spay and shelter, you know, for spay and neutering feral cats, because I think that that's one of the major issues with overcrowding, especially since we seem to be flying in dogs for adoption from all over the country and the world. I saw something from Thailand, too.
Hmm. Follow up?
Thank you, Marcia. Yes, Senator.
A tax deduction would be less impact on state revenue than a tax credit.
Frankly, it's still an impact on the state taxation. And until we address the structural deficit because of ballot measure 5 and ballot measure 4750 flipping what we do to pay for schools in this state, until we address that issue, it seems to me irresponsible to start giving away tax credits for everything else or even tax deductions.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Yeah, Marcia, I don't mean to be crass because it is my bill, but I will say I'm just looking here. They're going to build 94,000 new apartments in Portland, 17,000 new homes, and each one of those will have a refrigerator, a dishwasher, and a range, and each one of those we give a tax credit to. So if you do the math there, it's pretty substantial, much more than it is for dogs. And this is just for the Portland area. And when you look at the state overall of the housing we do and the tax credits we get on energy saving equipment, I think that's a bigger bump than it is on the pets.
I think it's a bigger bump, but it's not to say that I would get up and say that we shouldn't stop doing those tax credits either.
Good point.
Because I have been since 2001 in this building looking at tax expenditures and trying to address giving away money when we have structural problems and we're not providing schools, we're not providing other services. A family of three on TANF gets $506 to try to live.
Thank you. Yes, Marcia, thank you for being a consistent voice on this issue. Yes.
Yeah, and I guess that is, I do appreciate the same thing and have been impressed with your consistency and your dogged determination, so I appreciate that. I guess the thing I'm hearing, though, is that we have a problem with dogs and cats in our state, but beyond that problem, we're bringing in others. So if we are giving a tax credit and it is taking care of other states' problems, we're basically spending our taxpayer money on problems that other states and other groups are not taking care of. Do we know how many of those animals that are coming from all around the...
I do not know, but I can find that out because... but I just didn't have a whole bunch of time. I happen to know that however many they are coming. I think that Maui returned 57 dogs and cats to Oregon, and Washington last year. I think that's on the Maui pet fly or whatever it is. But I just barely was able to do the math. But I'll get some information and get it to you.
Follow up. Because the Sandy thing was a special occasion. That's a different, from my perspective, that was a humanitarian kind of thing you need to do. But if other states are using Oregon as a way to stop a problem that they should be addressing, I hope that they are still trying to address that problem with spaying, neutering programs, and other kinds of activities. So.
And I think part of the other, oh, excuse me, Chair Dimbrowen.
Yes.
This first time this session, I've forgotten my etiquette. Chair Dimbrow, Senator Roblin, yes, I agree that Sandy and Louisiana and any of those flood and disaster situations are a bit different on criticizing for flying them into the state. I think that some of the things that they're doing for disaster by recognizing pets as part of the evacuation is going to cut down on that. And I'm pleased to see that when we have warming shelters, we've had ways of containing the pets in carriers so that people are not afraid to come into the warming shelters as well. But I will try to get you some other figures.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
So, colleagues, I'll sounds like we'll be getting some additional information, and I'll be talking with the vice chair about next steps on this. Let me say just for the public that if we vote to approve this, it goes to our tax credits, goes to the revenue committee, where it'll be weighed against all the other tax credits that we're trying to get rid of, that we're considering.
You're spot on.
Let's be honest. That's a good
right.
Thing.
Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 326 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 372. And I'll ask Senator Hansel to come up. He is the sponsor of this bill, which does what?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 372 would direct the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules for the issuance of wildlife salvage permits to recover, possess, or transport deer or elk that have been accidentally killed as a result of a vehicle collision when the purpose is to salvage game meat. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, great. Senator Hansel, first time this session. Great to see you.
Senator Debo, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 372, known as the Wildlife Salvage Bill. I thought it might be helpful to give you some background on how this bill came to fruition. Frequently, as I'm driving in eastern Oregon where I live, I see deer hit and lying on the side of the road. These dead animals wait for either ODOT crews, county road crews, or time to dispose of the carcass. I found myself asking, is there a possibility for the driver that hit the animal to salvage the meat from these animals? Soon after I began thinking about the issue, an article was written in the October 2015 NSL magazine, which was entitled Faster Permits for Free-Range Deer. It stated that Wisconsin motorists can now contact the Department of Natural Resources and have a permit sent via email to them in order to salvage the meat of the animal they just hit. My office began compiling data on what some other states do in regards to wildlife salvage. I was surprised to find that 18 states across the nation allow for salvage of animals hit by motor vehicles. Most do so through permits issued by law enforcement or fish and wildlife officials. Some of these states include Vermont, New York, Florida, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, West Virginia, Colorado, and most recently, our neighbors to the north, Washington. In fact, Montana has taken their salvage program to the next level, and they are in the process of creating an app for your phone. When you hit an animal, you can submit the necessary information through the app to gain the salvage permit. In many states, the permit is free of charge. In addition to look what other states do, we also contacted ODOT to see if they had any record for how many animals were hit in the state. They said that of the animals reported to ODOT crews, 6,061 of the 6,700 animals hit were either deer or elk. So the vast majority were in fact elk and deer. Of those, 1,539 or 25% happened in ODOT Region 5, which is my district of Eastern Oregon. Currently, ODOT disposes of animal carcasses in a variety of methods through natural disposal, i.e. dragging them away from the public's view, in incineration if the carcass is from Clackamas County, or composting it if it hit occurs near a city like Heppner. In rare circumstances and in rare condition, burial occurs, and sometimes landfills, although most landfills do not accept animal carcasses. By leaving the animal close to where the hit occurred, it could draw predatory animals to the location. For example, if a deer is hit on Oregon Highway 204, which is also in my district, in the toll gate area, wolves and cougars could be drawn to the location, which is also home of many lakeside and forest cabins. Senate Bill 372 attempts to address the carcass on the road. It would allow for a person at no liability for the state to take the animal home if they so desire. We have been working with ODFNW's Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, throughout the entirety of this bill process. And through conversations with her, we left the official rulemaking to the department and to the commission. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions, colleagues? Senator Robler.
So when you were investigating other states, I mean, the first issue that comes to mind is that we just put some heavy fines on poaching in our state last session. Is it likely, or did you see any information? Because I think it's a wise use of good protein. But is there any information that someone might go after a deer with their truck and then take it so they can have it, and they could use that as a defense that I, you know, hit the deer and
shoot the deer.
Well, then shoot it, because we already have a rule that says you can put down an animal that has been injured. So,
you know,
I hate to say that, but it's just there are people that do this kind of stuff, and it just drives me crazy.
I hit a deer when I was a county commissioner in a county car. It was just a little ding, knocked out the headlight, that type of thing. It was $2,000. So if a person is going to hunt with your
with automobile, car. Could be expensive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't see any benefit of doing that. Yeah. And it certainly isn't the intent of this.
I know.
And it's just trying to make some positive out of an unfortunate situation.
Follow up. So you've hit the deer, and it either died or you put it down because it's that way. Do you have to get the permit before you can take it? I mean, you're out, and or do you take it and then send in all the paperwork? I mean,
this
how do
is
you
part
do
of well, Chair Dembrough and Senator Roblin. This is part of the rulemaking that will occur. We'll fashion it for the state of Oregon. From what I understand, Washington, having just done it, has a really effective and good program. I don't know that we need to reinvent the wheel. But I think we have plenty of states out there that have done it, and we could, you know, the department could begin to look at, you know, what have they done, what were the problems. We don't want to repeat them. And I think that's my goal, and I think what they would be willing to do.
Okay.
Great. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Following Senator Roblin's questioning, how would you handle a situation where someone actually physically goes out and shoots the deer and then picks it up? Because obviously there's not going to be anybody there to examine what happened and say, well, it hit my car and it got killed, or I just found it. And how would ODFW handle a situation that someone could physically kill a deer and say that they hit it and just take it home and keep the meat?
Senator Dembrough, Senator Olson, I'm sure that there are provisions that other states have. I don't know what they would be, to be honest with you. I believe that that's not an insurmountable issue, but there would be some way, you know, that I think it can be overcome. I don't have the solution with me.
A follow-up? Sure. One last question. I noticed that I'm very familiar with Florida. Many times that they have a game kill on the road, the meat has to be donated to a nonprofit, and I noticed that you didn't have this in here. Is there any reason why you couldn't just say this needs to go to the moose or the elk?
Yeah, right. And your car can go with it.
Yeah, no.
Or the lions.
Why, or the lions. why this meat that would be salvaged would be good to help feed the needy rather than just go back into the storage of someone that might not need it?
I think that's a very wise alternative or option that could certainly be put into it. Again, it would go back to rulemaking, but you know that could be an excellent way, particularly if you don't care for venison and you don't want to eat it, but you want to salvage it. You could certainly, I think, that would be a possibility to donate.
Well,
it, so.
I do support your vigor on this bill and the fact that you brought it forward. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah. So maybe to answer Senator Olson's question, I know this would be rulemaking, but clearly if we're going to set it up based on the animal being hit in an accident, make them take pictures of the vehicle itself.
There you go.
Something like that. I do know, and I just noticed that Steve Lane's here, who used to be OSP on the Fish and Wildlife Protection. And I know that law enforcement actually do sometimes where there's a kill that occurs like that, will actually advise like the mission in Eugene let them recover it and pass it. No, my biggest concern is someone just seeing something on the side of the road and then they doing it. I know it has a disclaimer here and a provision that you can't seek any damages if you recover and, let's say, have some type of issues because of eating bad meat. But, you know, it's one of those situations that it seems like there should be some way to be able to, if the animal can be preserved for salvage, that we should be able to do that. And it seems like through the rulemaking, they could figure out what would be right as to, because I mean, I could see what Senator Olson says. I'm thinking, well, someone shoots it and they say they go on the app and they get it, and who knows if they actually, you know, ran into it or it ran into them or they just go out there and poach it.
Those are excellent suggestions, Senator. Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little comment and a question. Senator Brzezinski, I don't know if you looked at the front of my truck, but I could run into a full-blown elk and you wouldn't know it.
That's true.
All right. That is a great concept. I'm going to have some discussions with Fish and Wildlife because there is some – it opens some opportunities for some fraud. There's no question about it where, you know, somebody could – poach an animal, run over it, take a picture of it next to a car that's got a smash fender, and away we go. So, you know, we're going to have some conversations with the agencies to actually see where we're going on this thing. We did increase the fines for poaching, which I voted no on, but that's another story. But at the end of the day, I think we got to put a little thought to it. I love the concept, though. I mean, you do hate to see these... Though animals that are hit pretty hard, the trauma is so bad that the meat is bruised and it's not really edible anyways. But we're going to have to walk this through a little bit more, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you for that comment. So we are going to hear from the agency in a moment. Yes, Senator Olson.
I would just like to make a comment and as to what we all referred to. If the meat went to a nonprofit, they could see if it in fact was shot or hurt. But the thing that I'm concerned about then is someone brings it in just to get rid of it and gives it to the nonprofit, and it's bad meat, then the nonprofit is stuck with the cost of dealing with it. So there's pros and cons to all of this. We've got to be very careful with it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Henson.
I concur, Senator DeMoro. I concur with all the concerns, and we were thinking through that. The thing that I keep coming back, 18 states have worked it out. So they're not insurmountable, and we're not leading this. We're not the first out of the chute on this. There's got to be some way to do it. I'll give you an example. In the first iteration of the bill, we had moose and antelope. Well, you'll notice they're not in there. ODF&W said, number one, we don't have any moose to worry about. And number two,
details.
If you hit an antelope, there ain't anything there to salvage no matter what vehicle you're driving.
That's
where
true.
You're driving it, Senator Bertrager's or not. So, you know, we're trying to make it. We've got literally over 6,000 of these animals that are, get hit every year. Even if we could only salvage a third of them, it would seem to me be worthwhile.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. You said you researched 18. Did you look at what their criteria were? Did you go to their Fish and Wildlife group and say that what's the criteria that they want to do and come up with a pattern of something very similar that we could use?
We did not, because that we felt, Senator Dembrough, Senator Olson, we did not, because we felt that would be, if we set the policy, then that would be the responsibility of the agency to implement it. So we didn't get down in the weeds on the particular things. We researched it. We found that we had 18 states. We looked at some of them. The one that came out in our limited investigation, that and maybe the ODFNW can illuminate on this, is what Washington has done. Seems like a program that has a lot of positives to it to look at.
Mr. Okay. Chair, if you have another iteration, I'd like to add raccoons. You know, I have a problem with the raccoon bill.
I don't want to kill the bill.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Hansel, for bringing this.
I appreciate you working me in. I've got to go back to my committee meeting.
Great. Okay, let's have Shannon and Doug, Shannon Hearn and Doug Cottom. Thank you. Welcome back. Welcome to 2017.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon Hearn. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We are feeling a little guilty because Senator Hansel pretty much covered all of our testimony, so we'll try and get through it quick and then offer what illumination we can. That being said, of course, we are neutral on the bill, but we do very much appreciate the time that we have spent with Senator Hansel, the education that's gone on there. Doug is going to run you through kind of the other states, what they're doing, and what makes Oregon unique in considering this program. So I'll let you
thank
know.
You. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Doug Cottom. I'm the Wildlife Division Administrator for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And, yeah, as Shannon said, much of what Senator Hansel had to say, I was going to say almost the same thing. A little bit of background about some of the other states. By my count, I thought that there was probably closer to 20 states which allow salvage of wildlife for a variety of reasons. It is actually kind of confusing when you start looking at many of the other states' rules and regulations. But Washington is the most recent state to adopt rules for salvaging deer and elk. They officially started in July of 2016. The state that kills the most animals, that's Pennsylvania, and in 2015 they killed over 126,000 animals collisions. Pretty incredible. They're one of the first states to adopt salvage bills as a result of that. And approximately something like 80,000 deer are killed in that state annually by automobiles. Many of the states like Montana and Pennsylvania only allow salvage for human consumption. Most states require a permit to be obtained within 24 hours after salvaging the animal.
Okay.
And to reduce the likelihood of poaching, states like Washington do not allow injured animals to be killed. The animal must be struck and killed by a vehicle. That's the only way they can actually salvage it. Nevertheless, in just 6 months, Washington has had 5 poaching cases already related to salvaging of road-struck animals. The department's unaware of how many animals we really have hit in this state. Many people who hit deer will just report to their insurance companies. We have lots of county road departments that get those kind of calls. It's, you know, really, it would take a lot of work to actually get close to an actual number of what's struck. But if ODOT has 6,000 or so phone calls, I'm sure it's more than that. Many of the animals that are struck are not edible. As an agency, we have a game meat certification class course that basically after taking that course, we typically do not allow people or salvage deer or elk for consumption by humans. Usually that would be the case if the animal, for instance, was only struck in the head. Most of the time, the damage that they incur from a vehicle causes a lot of organ damage and contamination of the meat. We do appreciate that the bill relieves some liability for the department and the commission. And we would very likely, one of our rules would very likely be we would ask that the entire animal be removed from the roadway entirely. For that, you know, that would help with the safety issues of dealing with an animal alongside a roadway. It would also help reduce the possibility of other wildlife being struck and killed, eating the remains of the animals that are left alongside the road. And especially in the case of an elk, it would be easy to see people would just take parts of animals if we didn't require them to take the whole thing, since elk are rather large. There was a few other issues that we need to address. We need clarification, either in statute or by rule, that the consumption of the animals is by humans only. There are people would use the meat for a variety of purposes other than just eating it themselves, for instance, giving it to their pets. There is a conflict that we believe exists between this statute and another statute, one we already heard about a little earlier. That's revised statute 498.016. That's the humane statute, which allows people, the citizens of Oregon, to humanely kill animals that have been that are helpless or incapacitated. We believe that could possibly create a loophole in the situation where people would be able to shoot an injured animal and kill it and take it home, or possibly shoot an animal that is not injured and then either strike it with a vehicle or take it home and try to get away with it. The bill does require people to promptly return the antlers of bucks and bulls, which is a good thing. In this state, people can sell antlers. And I did a little research, and it appears that at least last year, the average price for antlers was about up to $12 a pound. So there is a lot of value in antlers. And finally, there was one other thing wanted to mention, that along the lower Columbia River, we do have a listed subspecies of white-tailed deer, the Columbian white-tailed deer, which is protected by federal law. And so they cannot be handled. So we would very likely have to create a rule that would not allow the salvage of deer in Clatsop, Columbia, and Multnomah counties. And that would really mimic what the state of Washington has done for their lower Columbia River counties as well. That's it for my presentation. Questions?
Yes, Senator Bertrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill is, you know, it has merit, and I understand where Senator Hansel is coming from, and I agree. I live in a rural community, see it all the time. Hit a few myself over the years. But I do worry. Even the antler thing, you know, how are we going to document? I mean, we're going to have a Fish and Wildlife employee come out, or are we just going to, if they're just going to submit a photo or something, it could be a photo of anything. You know, I mean, this is the day and age of create what you want. And so I think we have to have some discussion how to close those loopholes. I really do.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, Senator Olson.
I would think in today's age of technology, everybody carries a cell phone. I mean, because we see the YouTube videos all the time. And I think that would be one way that you could get over the documentation of a hit of an animal that was hit. Take pictures of the animal, take pictures of your car, prove that you actually hit this animal, or someone hit it in front of you and you could see the damage from the car on the animal. Now, that's another, I guess that leads me to another question. If someone else hits it, can you salvage it right after them?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, that is our understanding is yes, you could find it after being struck and then.
Okay.
Yeah.
So technology could lead us to a resolution of was the animal shot or was the animal hit by a vehicle, and that could be maybe part of your criteria. You must send in pictures to show to prove that it was there.
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, yeah, we have discussed that. There would be a need certainly, especially with the humane statute that we have in Oregon that is different than most states, to prove why and how that animal was taken.
Senator Roble.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for the work you've done to get to have the information we have, because I agree. In other states where you can't humanely put an animal down, if it's shot, you kind of have a problem that they have a problem. In our state, you break a leg, the deer goes off into the woods, and then wanders back to the, limps back, and is in a lot of pain. Someone sees it, they decide we're going to put it out of its misery, which is what the humane statute does. They shoot it and go. I mean, that's what in the past. Now, they shoot and take it home, and then it makes it really hard for you to decide, you know, who hit it, what, all of those kinds of things. But I appreciate the work you have done. I thanks for talking to me earlier. So I'm impressed that we're looking at it close enough to maybe make it work. And I would love to see it work, because I'm one of those people that would really love to see it go to food banks and other kinds of stuff if we could figure out how to do that. I don't have any problem with the other people taking it, but I just think that we have a need, and it would be kind of interesting to see that work too. So. But thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Last question.
I wouldn't mind adding turkeys and pheasants and geese and ducks.
Yeah, then you get eagles, and that's a problem.
Right.
Okay. Thank you both very much. It seems like amendments may be in order here before we come back, and so I'm sure Senator Hansel will work on those.
Mine probably did.
So thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 372, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 19.
I'm going to write a book someday. Aren't
Beth, you want to discuss this or present this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 19 would update the descriptions and allowed quantities of oxygenates and gasoline for sale at wholesale or retail in Oregon. There is not yet a fiscal revenue statement on the bill and no subsequent referral.
Okay, I'm going to ask Lauren to come up on behalf of the Department of Agriculture, and you have others. That's great.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough. For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I apologize, I have a cold, and I will try to get through this without sneezing. We are bringing to you Senate Bill 19, which is a statutory cleanup and simplification bill. It is that we have a history in our agency of trying to go through our statutes and where we think appropriate to make minor changes or areas that just haven't kept up, to bring them to you for those minor changes. Senate Bill 19 is one of those. It 646, or a 646, is the state's vehicle fuels section, and that's the section we're talking about in 646. I did want to mention, in looking at OLIS, the Legislative Information System, I noticed that you may hear some opposition to what we're talking about today. What I saw on OLIS was the primary opposition was the prohibition or the restriction on butanol in that. And I just wanted to mention to you, butanol and the other substances were restricted on the onset of the original language for ethanol and biodiesel many years ago. This bill does not change that underpinning at all. It merely just brings forward updates and some clarifications, either bringing things into current standards or changing common names that were originally did not have and using industry standards for those. It does really three things. It cleans up statutory language regarding the gasoline and ethanol blending requirements. It cleans up and simplifies requirements for labeling of gasoline with oxygenates like ethanol. And then it simplifies the statutory list of substances that cannot be blended into gasoline by using common names and abbreviations. And that last piece I just mentioned is where you would hear about butanol in that list. Chair Dimbrough, if you would like, and I'll just admit right up front, when we get too far into talking about vehicle fuels, it gets complicated really fast, which is why I have my colleagues with me today. We can go through each section or just stop here and answer any questions that you might have.
If you or either of your colleagues could just kind of clarify what the changes do you know, kind of in general, or you know, why this need to clean them up?
Chair Dembrough, effectively, Steve Harrington, Department of Agriculture. I'm the Weights and Measures Program Manager and Motor Fuel Quality Program Manager as well. The changes that are designed in this document should have a net zero impact on the laws and regulations that we're applying to motor fuel quality, the standards that we're applying to the sale of fuels in the market. The can I borrow your list of simplifications there? If I would just go through, when we're talking about the cleanup of statutory languages regarding gasoline and ethanol blending requirements, in the statute there are, we're looking at three distinct products. We're looking at ethanol, fuel ethanol, denatured fuel ethanol. And what was not clear, I think, in the original language was that when we were applying a 9.2% to 10% blending standard, we were talking about ethanol. Denatured fuel ethanol contains ethanol plus a certain quantity of denaturant, which is not detectable in the laboratory. So when we pull a laboratory sample for determining compliance with the ethanol mandate, we're looking for 9.2 to 10% anhydrous ethanol with the assumption that the other 0.8 of a percent is included in the denaturant. The simplification of the list of substances which cannot be blended into gasoline by using common names of and abbreviations. Essentially what we're looking at here is there's a number of chemical names which are listed out explicitly in statute, and in our opinion some of those could be reduced down to common names. So we mentioned butanol as a substance that had been previously on the list of prohibited substances and remains on the list of prohibited substances in this bill. There is isobutanol, N-butanol, sec-butanol. These are all isomers of the butanol molecule. We simply want to reduce that to butanols or butanol and all structural isomers. It's a matter of simplification. And there are several other examples in there. As far as moving on to the simplification for requirements for labeling gasoline with oxygenates like ethanol. There is, in the existing statute, there is references to labeling requirements for areas which are subject to, or which have been declared carbon monoxide non-attainment areas, which would have been at one point the Portland metro area, and I would assume the Salem area as well. Those are not carbon monoxide non-attainment areas at this point, and so the labeling requirements that are contained in the Environmental Protection Agency regulations no longer really, they're not really relevant at the moment, so having them explicitly in statute seems a little burdensome. Certainly something that if it were to come to light in the future, we could address an agency rule, because maintaining the oxygen labeling standards is something that we do routinely today. What it would also do, there is a strict requirement that we mandate, or that we impose labeling requirements on the sale of all gasoline through the motor fuel dispenser at retail, that we require labeling of the oxygenate at the pump, the principal oxygenate typically being ethanol today. So when you go to the gas station today, you'll see 10% ethanol on that dispenser very, very routinely. That's where the beginnings of that's where the origin of that label is in this section of statute. What we've done is to essentially ask that the requirement that that label be there be moved to the agency may require that label to be there, which would allow us to work a little bit more with our stakeholders in order to adjust labeling requirements as we're looking at a dynamic renewable fuels market in the future. May be appropriate to address 15% ethanol, or as our colleagues in other areas that are a renewable fuel industry, we may be looking at addressing butanol in the future should that blending requirement be lifted. I think that summarizes the majority of what we're looking at.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, why don't we hear from, we have somebody on the phone from the Personal Watercraft Industry Association, who I think provided written testimony, and he's here to speak as well via phone. So why don't we hear from him? If you could just stay there in case any questions need to be answered.
Should be good if you call his name.
Okay. Mr. Dickerson, yes, welcome. And it's probably a few hours later where you are, but thank you for your patience. Anyway, you now know all about shelter animals and roadkill and all sorts of interesting things.
Both of which I'm actually interested in. But at this moment, we're here to talk about something that isn't quite so captivating, but I think from perspective of the voters in Oregon, the 170,000 voters, this is pretty important stuff. So first let me introduce myself. I am the Vice President of State Government Affairs at the National Marine Manufacturers, and we represent about 1,200 manufacturers of boats, engines, trailers, and accessories. The industry is big. It has 11.9 million boats and $121 billion in economic impact. But as importantly, in Oregon, boating is about a $1.7 billion economic impact. And as I said, there's 170,000 registered boats. The reason we flagged AB 19, and I apologize for us coming a little bit late to the party here, but we didn't catch exactly what concerns us until it was really the last minute here. But the reason I'm here is AB 19, in my mind, provides an excellent opportunity to expand and benefit boaters. Right now, the state does have basically a ban on isobutanol, and this bill would expand the terminology to include other types. And as the prior testimony showed, it was to include all different types of butanol. But our request today is that we take out the isobutanol and butanol reference altogether. And the reason for that is that there's been an awful lot of innovation in the industry and in the fuels industry that this bill would preclude. There is no hotter button in boating than ethanol. Ethanol is can cause your boat to run rough. It can cause seals to degrade, and particularly as you get into higher percentages in blends, it can destroy the engine. So we at NMMA have been very concerned about it, and 5 years ago, we began a testing program under the auspices of Argonne Labs and the Department of Energy, EPA, and U.S. Coast Guard, and the testing was on isobutanol. And what we found was that it is a superior alternative to ethanol. It provides more energy value than ethanol. It does not corrode seals or damage pistons or other engine parts. And it does not phase separate as ethanol does, which means it doesn't absorb moisture from the air. And if you leave it sit for a while, the fuel and the water separate, and you can end up with an engine that simply can't run on the fuel in its tank. This is a lot different than what you would have with your car. Unfortunately, those of us own boats don't get out as often as we'd like, and that fuel can sit in a tank for quite a while, giving plenty of opportunity for it to phase separate. So to find a fuel that doesn't phase separate, that doesn't damage the engine, that doesn't that also provides more energy value, was really a tremendous discovery for us. And the EPA took a look at the results, and they have approved motor fuel blends of up to 16% for isobutanol for marine and off-road engines, and then also 12.5% for on-road engines, which would be cars. I'm really here to talk about more of the 16.1% isobutanol and the benefits that it provides. It is, it's a fact that if you use ethanol at 16%, you've really put yourself into a difficult situation as a boater. Even if your engine is going to not immediately, or not, I shouldn't say immediately, but even if it doesn't have substantive problems. It is going to have difficulty in starting and other things. So as we see the move, as was mentioned earlier, from E10 to E15, 10 or 15% blend of ethanol, it only raises our concern and increases our hope that isobutanol will be in the marketplace, particularly at marinas, for the near term and hopefully over time at your local gas station. So with that in mind, we see this bill, honestly, as an opportunity to reach out and say, well, we've got a lot of innovation here. We have new opportunities to serve the boaters and to make boaters safer overall. So I don't know. I asked the experts before I was able to talk with you all today, is there an environmental reason why butanol would be a concern over ethanol? And the answer I received was, no, they didn't know of one. I'm certainly open to discussing it, and I'd be delighted to know if there was a concern in Oregon for the use of butanol as a fuel blend. But as it sits today, I would just ask the committee to take a hard look at it and consider lifting this basic ban on the use of butanol. You have before you an awful lot of agate print in the butanol fact sheet that really lays out the case in great detail as approved by these tests. You also have a letter from my boss, John McKnight, who is an engineer who led this testing program that can fill in, I think, a lot of the gaps that might be there technologically. But my job here today was simply to kind of put it in English and let you know that this is a great opportunity to change what the existing law has been, and instead of simply broadening the definition, to change the fuel policy to benefit voters.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Dickerson. I have to admit this is a subject I know nothing about. However, we do have some people in the room who can help us. So, gentlemen at the... there, anybody from the ag team who can?
So once again, this is Lauren, the assistant director. I will just mention briefly the statute itself already has an exemption for watercraft for clear gas. Mm-hmm. That's already in there. I think when this was all put in place, it was very clear there was some concerns, and I remember the testimony around boats. They don't do well with it, and they don't. My folks have one and have to get the clear gas. I know aircraft was an issue, as were small engines, were one also. So that's already in. I think at that particular point in time, and I'm aging myself a little bit because I don't remember how many sessions ago that was, but there was some concern about supply and that there just wasn't the clear gas available. I think that list has grown a while. I can't tell you how many. We'd have to go to the Oregon State Marine Board, I think it is, who keeps that list, and we could look at that list. I would ask Steve or Jason, could you make a comment about this for watercraft?
Yeah, and specifically the isobutanol question.
Chair Dembrell, testimony, I think, is accurate in terms of butanol has advantages over ethanol in terms of its ability to absorb water. Obviously, in a marine application, that water is a concern, and that's in order to allow the use of butanol in the state of Oregon, that's going to require a statutory change. That's something. I mean, we can certainly offer some technical advice on what that might be. Certainly our agency is not in a position where we're neither supporting or opposing this particular.
From your perspective, what are the downsides of allowing isobutanol?
None that I'm aware of.
So why was the restriction put in the first place? Did anyone know?
The expense of totally getting this wrong. My memory serves me well. At that particular point in time, there was a lot of interest in trying to get ethanol production in Oregon up, and I remember there were some issues about that, and I don't remember if that's why butanol was specifically put in there, but it's all time and place, I think. I think we've moved maybe past some of that since then.
Vice Chair.
Not a problem. Thank you. As I read Senate Bill 19, I might be mistaken, and please clarify and tell me if I'm wrong, but it says in Section 1, this is as a fuel for motor vehicles that are operated on public streets or highways. So it really doesn't have to deal with boats. Or am I correct on that? You're just banning this from public highways, not from watercraft.
That's correct. Section ORIS 9, the first section is for those that are on the highway. I think one of the other issues before we get too far in this is Oregon doesn't have a lot of refineries and make its own, so we're kind of at what comes down the pipe, so to speak. And so there's always been a supply issue on what's available to us. I think if there is some interest of this committee in exploring this further, I think we'd like a chance to talk to those folks about that and maybe do a little bit of explorations with other states to see what they've done in this area.
Follow up?
Yes.
And to Mr. Dickerson, is it Mr. Dickerson?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Dickerson, yeah, I hope you can hear me. I am a boater, and I've always been very conscious about the fact that what ethanol would do to my outboard, and made certain that I bought clear gas, 92 octane, so that it wouldn't hurt it. But the problem is that as we go through these restrictions, we have the refiners, we have the distributors that don't have the capacity to carry all the different fuels that are necessary to supply us with what we need. And along the line of Mr. Dickerson, if we could get isobutanol into the gas supply where it's a better, more efficient fuel, we would kind of kill two birds with one stone. We would have a hotter, cleaner, more productive fuel that could be used in everything. Uh-oh, I see we got a... It's only for roads.
My apologies, Senator.
It's only for roads. Are we okay?
I was wondering if the list is... Chair Dembro.
Yes.
The if the list is a list of ores, so in Section 1, a wholesale dealer or retail dealer may not sell or offer for sale gasoline, as a motor fuel, that as a motor fuel, and et cetera. B, that contains the following, that contains methyl tertiary butyl ether, or C, that contains any combination of the following substances in concentrations exceeding. So essentially, A is addressing the transportation fuel. A lot of the EPA regulations apply specifically to motor vehicles that are operated on the public roadways.
Mm-hmm. Right. So B would apply to both.
B
and C are independent.
Right. So that we can't sell isopropanol.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. So I got that right. So it doesn't make any difference. We can't use it in the boat anyhow because we can't buy it.
Right.
At this point. That's
correct. At this point.
Yes. Senator Robo.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank the testimony. Being a senator from the coast of Oregon, when this first bill came out, it frightened all of my fishermen and other people because of the water problem. And we did solve that problem. And most of the places you got clear gas were at marinas. So, you know, and yet there were some other issues about needing gas for off-road vehicles and so on and so forth. So if the new science is coming out, I certainly hope that we will consider looking at it, if not in this bill, and I understand why they looked at this bill, because it gave them an opportunity. If the research is out there and we can find a supply, because that's another issue, is where do they mix it and how do they do that? I agree with Senator Olson.
I can address a couple of those
perfect.
Things. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Dickerson.
Oh, okay, good. I'm watching you on the screen, but you're very small.
No, that's me.
Yeah, that's me.
a few things. Unfortunately, a blend that uses isobutanol does not have more energy than clear gas. It does have more energy than ethanol.
Right.
Yeah, so I just wanted to clarify that.
Right.
The second thing is that you're right, that clear gas may be a product of the past. It is, as we also start to see E15 coming into the marketplace, and of course now E10 already is a standard. You know, we're starting to see that now in a section of Maryland where I live. There's not many sections that have it, and that may also be part of the problem, is that the vendors can hardly get their hands on it.
Right.
So while it's in this bill or not, and I apologize if I've taken up your time on something that may not be entirely germane, overall, we'd be delighted to work with your agencies or committees to pave the way, you know, just looking forward for the state of Oregon to be open for, you know, an isobutanol option to be available. You don't want to wait until all of a sudden the spigot starts to run dry with clear gas. I'm not saying it's going to, you know, literally run dry immediately, but it could happen in a season or two. You know, we're kind of teetering on a balance here from a national perspective when you talk to the refineries where they're not really delighted with messing with it anymore. So over a season or two, you could start to see it becoming even more difficult. The other advantage of particularly if you're able to get it at the higher blend, the 16.1% approved blend, it actually could cost less than clear gas. So just in the same way that one of the arguments in support of E15 is that you can sometimes find it for less than even E10, it stands to reason that isobutanol 16 could also give you a reasonable alternative. It wouldn't have all the boost of clear gas, but it's in between clear gas and ethanol, and a price point that would be perhaps better, particularly as E0 starts to become more difficult to obtain.
Okay, great. Thank you. Senator Przanski.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Dickinson, we have one other person in the room. I'm not sure if Mr. Romaine is going to be testifying or not. My question is, if you know, our refineries, I believe, are all the gas is coming out of Washington State. Do you know if Washington State has butanol available now in their refinery process?
I know they don't. I shouldn't say the refinery process. I know that it's now available in, I believe, 5 or 6 states in a limited way. You know, it's just ramping up. But DuPont and other major, manufacturers are very invested in this. They see it as the future, and they know that because it's based on corn as well, we don't face, you know, the political problem, frankly, of strong supporters of farms and grain. Who have said, you know, ethanol has been a lifesaver for the family farm, which it truly has. We are not against renewable fuels. And, in fact, if ethanol didn't provide the problems that it does, we wouldn't have a problem with ethanol either. But this isn't an anti-ethanol as much as it is a pro-isobutanol situation. Now, the other thing about isobutanol that really is far down the road, though, is it doesn't have to be blended either at the pump or in the tank or just as it's about to leave the jobber. Because it is far less corrosive, it can be used in a pipeline type of transportation system. So it's really a new way of obtaining a renewable fuel and continuing to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And one thing I didn't mention was, just from a pollution point of view, isobutanol has a lower vapor pressure, which simply means it's
not evaporating,
not trying to push out of the container as strongly as would ethanol, so you have less off-gassing, which is a major evaporative emissions is a major pollutant. So,
yes, thank
overall,
you.
It's something that I'd love to explore with you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Dickerson. This is very helpful and productive. Senator Bertschinger, and then we'll wrap up.
Quick question, probably for our fuel guru here. I got a little experience in this, but it sounds like the basic difference between ethanol and isobutanol is ethanol won't mix with water and the butanol will.
No, the other way around.
The other way?
Ethanol will.
Ethanol absorbs water.
Oh, yeah, that's what. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, the ethanol will mix with water and the isobutanol will. Because that's one problem we have in tanks where you store the ethanol for a long time, the condensation, and it'll mix with the ethanol, wind up at the bottom of the tank. And it
eats up small engine carburetors.
So, Chair Dembrough, if I could, I think, why don't we go back and if Beth, if you wouldn't mind giving us the contact information there, and these folks can chat a little bit about this, and maybe there's a way, from what I'm hearing today, to maybe have a carve-out or some consideration for butanol for watercraft and something in there without maybe changing the underlying pieces of this statute, which were worked on real hard by all of you several years ago. But I'll let these folks have that conversation, and we'll report back.
No, I think that's great, Lauren. And I've asked the vice chair to take the lead on this for the committee. And so if he could help coordinate, with Beth. And we'll get the word out. So if anybody has concerns about this change, they can let us know that, and we can perhaps get this resolved. And it sounds like perhaps take advantage of this bill to fix a problem that we may or may not be able to get the butanol in, but if we do, at least it wouldn't be prohibited. Senator Brzezinski?
Yeah, I was just going to follow up, and I think since Senator Olson's going to be doing this, it may be something that we want to be proactive, and if we could have a language that would allow for the agency to be able to allow the butanol to come into the system once it's available, that way we wouldn't have to be having another bill come before us and do that type of thing. So there could be some different price points, push points, whatever you want to call them, that availability points that would allow for that to happen at the administrative level without us needing to reopen it as a legislation.
Right. Okay, then. Mr. Dickerson, thank you again for your input and your patience. It's been very helpful. And thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for your help, and looks like we'll be calling on you some more. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 19. Stay tuned. We'll let you know how this work is going. And colleagues, again, until tomorrow, we are adjourned. Adjourned. We are adjourned.